Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's Fresnolandia, we are talking with Jennifer Lasara, the founder and CEO of Lasara Development Consultants, a housing consulting firm based in San Diego, where she and her team advise state and local governments on how to create more resilient communities, as well as solving our housing crisis. She also leads the Global Policy Leadership Academy, where they bring leaders from California to cities across the globe to learn best practices in solving for housing affordability and homelessness. She's brought several delegations of Fresno leaders to Vienna, for example, to learn more about their social housing model, which we will talk more about later today.
We're really excited to talk to you. It's a fun time for housing. Housing is in national leaders' mouths these days. Housing policy, thinking about it, there was a book that came out this year called Abundance. Actually, it's last year now. Mm-hmm. We're in 2026. That pulled on a lot of strings as to what the problem might be.
It's on everybody's minds. It's actually on everybody's pocketbooks because it's become a global crisis, and especially in high-cost communities across the United States and in Europe. In fact, the housing crisis is actually worse in Europe than it is here, but it's on all of our minds because it's gone up so much over the last decade.
Did you read Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson's book?
I did, and I'm going to be rereading it because I teach at Stanford once a year. Okay. And so I just finished my first class Wednesday, and the first two chapters of it are on our quiz next week.
Okay, what do you make of the book with their argument? Are there things that they're missing? Donnie and I cover stuff in Fresno, and we often feel like the book is speaking to a broad problem that doesn't really speak to Fresno's specific issues directly.
Yeah, I think it speaks a lot to the flaws of the Democratic strategy and how we've, as Democrats, really layered on a lot of regulations with good intentions for the outcome so that we want to achieve, but we've just made housing very expensive. And I think that's a good thing for us to hear. I think it picks a little too much on things like high-speed rail, which are very local to Fresno, because one of the flaws of our funding system here in the United States is we do so much year-over-year funding. For example, in Vienna, they'll commit to funding a transit system, and it'll be many years of funding, right, so that we can get rail from the urban core to an emerging community. Here, we just kill ourselves in the way that we have to go after funding year after year for major infrastructure. So I feel like some of those things are oversimplified, but I think Abundance does a good job of helping us think about how we really need to do it better.
Do you think they accurately diagnose why it's so expensive in California?
I think they draw good comparisons between market rate housing or affordable housing built more with private sector capital and the many layers that add a lot of expense here to the affordable sector. It is the book du jour. And I just got my class certified as a Cardinal class at Stanford. It's an undergraduate class. So it means that we do a community project. So we're going to work with the city of Mountain View. So I went into the Cardinal catalog and I'm like, there are like 10 Abundance classes. At Stanford, I'm like, I didn't think they were that trendy.
Wow.
So I'm thinking it's overused. Like, yeah. It's become it has created the dialogue around affordability.
Yeah, it's a broach to conversation.
It's really important that it's a bipartisan dialogue. And it's important that it's a bipartisan dialogue at the federal level because we have to have bipartisan solutions.
Absolutely.
So what are federal policy solutions that could solve for affordability specifically in Fresno?
Anything that reduces regulation. So NEPA is the federal version of CEQA. All the types of federal money that come, whether it's transportation money that often has a sort of set of carrots around housing and housing planning, all the federal housing money, which is very much a political football these days, but anywhere we can reduce regulation. And it's a good time for the federal government and the Republican-led Congress and administration to work on pushing back on regulation. And Gavin Newsom's done a good job, right? Never lose the benefit of a crisis to do something positive, and he rolled back CEQA because of the LA fires. We've needed that.
So in Fresno, and I know you've spent a lot of time working in Fresno on policy issues, something I've observed adjacent to the policy space is that we've done massive zoning reform.
Yes.
We have ministerial approval for many types of housing projects across the city, especially in downtown. The wait time to get a permit is dramatically lower in Fresno than it is in most major cities in California. And yet we're doing just a fraction of housing downtown in our infill areas. What do you see as some of the biggest obstacles besides permitting, since that doesn't seem to be a huge of an issue here?
Let me congratulate Fresno on setting the table. All those things that you just named, are really admirable. 10,000 units in downtown, outstanding. The amount of density that we can put here. One of Fresno's biggest challenges is structural, in that the cost to build here are maybe 95% of the cost in the big cities, but almost comparable cost to build.
But and why is that? That our housing costs, like our building costs, are so similar to
San Is that more Francisco. Construction industry related?
Hard costs, yeah. Capital, right? Mm-hmm. Lumber, steel, right? All materials. That pricing is uniform pretty much across the state. The cost of capital is uniform, or Fresno's probably going to have a capital penalty because the market's not as strong here. But the biggest obstacle is that the incomes are so much lower relative to the cost to build. So if incomes are 40% higher in a San Diego or a Long Beach or San Jose or Sacramento, then you can leverage up a lot more private capital. You don't have the market. You don't have the people to pay those rents. And one of the, I mean, you just, your average incomes are lower. And one of the problems of the private capital markets, and I've seen this in other places as well, and I'm not saying Fresno isn't a great place to build, but the way the capital markets work is until they can see three proven projects, right? So if whatever, $3,000 one-bedroom apartments actually could find a market here, the private marketplace, the bankers want to see three projects where that's already been done. You can't get the first one built. And so anytime you're trying to create a new market, like we're trying to, the vision is a new marketplace in downtown Fresno, right? New construction, mm-hmm. a mix of middle and high density. But until we have a couple of those projects, the private bankers just won't come in. They're so risk adverse in their underwriting. And that's where you need different kinds of investors. They're philanthropic investors, or they're investors that are incentivized by federal tax credits, opportunity zones, as we've talked about, historic tax credits that can take the edge off. But we need some kind of softer capital that is willing to invest in the first couple projects to make the market.
Can you have consistent development with kind of alternative funding sources that are not traditional, like banking? If you have to go out and hunt down investors that have philanthropic mindsets, is that going to be more challenging to build consistently?
Sure. And in some places, the market's been made by an enterprising company, right? You could have an employer that just funds that. You could have places that have been rebuilt, like Detroit, right? You've had big foundations. And we don't have big foundations here. And I don't see that you have any corporations that are big enough to step up and make that market willing.
We have large public institutions that could potentially flex their retirement plans.
Yes.
But that requires a level of creativity, possibly.
And I'll give you an example. Hospitals are great candidates to build. We work a lot with educational institutions who have the land and sometimes actually have the capital and have a need to build workforce housing for their employees. So there are definitely ways.
So the tools exist.
They do.
But you need a person or a developer. Who's the person that drives that train to make it happen?
A catalytic leader can be anybody, but it's just got to be somebody who is respected and can lead that charge. So,
do you have examples of a person like that? How they emerged and how they developed the ability to corral all of those resources and be a force multiplier for a city?
I think it was Kresge, I believe, in Detroit. I think it was, do you remember the shoe company Zippo, I think it was, in Las Vegas? The Chicago difference, how it was parks but not housing, but the Great Park was built by one mayor who was like, that's all we're going to do. And where are we doing a great job? Bloomberg did a great job in New York, honestly, and was a wealthy businessman, had the tools, but just had the drive, created the infrastructure. So a leader can be a business person, it can be an elected, it can be a philanthropist, hell, it could be like your NBA player is a superstar, right? But it has to just be somebody who makes that commitment to talk to 1,000 people and message again and again.
Yeah.
And consistency, right, of time to build the coalition.
I think we're really impatient in Fresno. I don't know. Because we've been, at least, so I returned first time to Fresno after going to college in 2000, at the end of 2006. And I was with a 21-year-old who's like ready to take on downtown. And here we are 20 years later, I feel like we're having the same conversations.
Yeah.
And there have been some really great leaders in that time frame and some good policy jumps, but it's like Fresno hasn't hit that tipping point. And I think I just struggle a lot with what is going to be our tipping point.
And I think that, you know, I love elected officials, of course, and do a lot of work to support them, but they come and go. And a dynamic mayor can move the needle, but any mayor is only going to be there for 8 years at the most. So how do you start to think about sustainable structures where you embed that leadership and that momentum? And I more and more just really believe in that, because you see in different regions a dynamic leader come in, but then they're elected and they go out.
Yeah, how do you get them to think long term? I think that the incentive structure is so short term these days.
One of the things that I've been involved in all of them, and it's very new, is we're really seeing the creation of regional housing finance agencies. And I'm starting to be a big believer in that model, because we can take it outside of elected government and build some sustainability. So in the Bay Area, BAFA was the first one, came out of a special legislation, and covers all 9 counties. LA followed, but unsuccessful in getting their measure. They had to pull it back from the ballot. So they were the early horse out of the gate, embedded in ABAG and MTC, right? So their Metropolitan Planning Agency, so embedded in big government. In LA, they wanted to do the same thing. They didn't want to house it in the city or the county, so they created La Casa, another one-time piece of special legislation. It's countywide, but it's a fresh entity. They were successful with their sales tax measure, $1 billion a year. In LA, can you imagine right now? $1 billion a year. Forever. There's technically a sunset, but in San Diego, we're the first regional housing finance agency under SB 440, which was a bill that said you don't have to have special legislation to create these anymore. We can create them by. So we did. Doesn't cost anything. It doesn't cost millions of dollars that they spent in the Bay Area or LA to build the coalitions, et cetera. We don't have any financing sources yet, but we have 2 education partners. We'll put together an advisory board and then work on a capitalization plan. And I actually think that could be a mechanism for Fresno, because you've got a lot of good energy in the mayor's office. There's been almost $300 million committed for the infrastructure in downtown. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you're thinking, when am I going to see the buildings?
Yeah.
And we have a mayor that's not going to be there, and he's got, I think, two and a half more years. So how do we think about building a sustainable structure here that you could embed the capacity but also the leadership?
Yeah.
So that's my next good idea of how we try and sustain high energy focused on housing development. And the thing I like about the regional housing finance agencies, they're customized really to local need. In LA, it's rental housing and homelessness mostly, although they have some money for social housing and innovation. In San Diego, we're more moderate, less identified as being a renter community, and we'll probably focus a lot more on workforce housing and hopefully on models of first-time home ownership. We'll be thinking about how do we house staff at our schools and how do we house just everyday workers, not just low-income folks.
How do you think about priorities for Fresno with that lens?
I think for Fresno, and I was here and able to see the infrastructure money coming. You can see it now downtown, the sidewalks and the curb cuts and the progress at the high-speed rail with the underpasses finally starting to open up. So I think that's a really good sign. I think that it is, and I won't say that I know your development community, but for the vision of housing that you have, do you have the right mix of developers here? Maybe you do. Certainly don't have the capital you need. And so how do we think about you guys creating the capital streams that are needed to develop especially mixed income and moderate workforce housing?
We talk about that a lot. Do we have the right developers? And I think they're very good at building single family homes on the outskirts of the city, but I don't know, talking about capacity, what the capacity would be like for single projects or boutique projects, if you will.
Yeah, I've seen your planned communities are beautiful, right? You get on the highway, though, you drive to them. So how do you get, I think what you're really getting at is how do you build infill housing?
Yeah.
And infill housing is, the best developers I've seen are pretty small. They're very focused. And they're developing projects that are anywhere from 30 to 150 units. And they're pretty flexible, right? They'll do new construction, they'll do adaptive reuse, they're really creative, but when you talk to them, their biggest challenge is actually these days they have to have 100% coverage of their construction loans. So you have a $10 million project, you have an $8 million construction loan, you're supposed to have $8 million sitting in the bank, right? That's really difficult. And so we are been on our own listening tour with infill developers and understanding the challenges in the regions, and this seems to be pretty universal. So we've started to think about how could we maybe build a coalition to maybe work with CalHFA or the state agency or frankly some of the retirement funds to just do a construction loan guarantee fund, not even the dollars. And that is not a super high risk tool. It's not even that expensive. It's about finding entities that are willing to put their balance sheet up. And could we entice employers to the table? Could a hospital do that? Could a pension fund do that? Yeah, they all could. But how do we, the infill developer's so busy just on the infill. And I think they're good at the tools, whether I think it's opportunity zones, it's new market tax credits, it's historic credits, but they just can't figure out how to make it a scaled business yet.
It's less lucrative.
Yeah. And I think that's been my observation in Fresno is that because it is substantively less lucrative and it's slower money, the incentive structure doesn't exist to replicate that model here.
And institutional investors really only like things that are 150 units.
Yeah.
It's great to see the infrastructure money in downtown. I can see it as I walk around, but I don't see a lot of new building yet.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would love to pivot to Vienna, since you do many trips to Vienna each year. What first captivated you about Vienna and their social housing model?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think the thing about Vienna, a couple of different, very different things that resonated for us. First, the ability to conceptualize and execute housing at scale. And when I say that, I think of this idea that we should be planning 3,000, 5,000, and 10,000 units at a time and master planning the capital. Just like you've actually master planned the zoning here. And again, like kudos, this is unusual. So you laid the land use work here, but nobody has master planned the capital. Nobody has yet master planned what it means to actually bid the land out in tranches so we create some real momentum. And you have a lot of land. So we liked the Vienna model because government land banks a land supply of 10 to 15 years. And the result of that is that 60% of the people in Vienna live in social housing. Social housing is basically pretty large mixed income communities, one-third low, one-third middle, one-third market. And they pay 27% of their income in rent. 60% of the city of Vienna, it's a city of 2 million people, same size as San Diego. Can you imagine paying 27% of your income? And they have enough money to go out to eat and to buy little country cabins. And so it's an economy that works. And it's a capitalist economy. It's a very educated economy. So we liked that it was one of the world's most livable cities because it was affordable. But I also like that it really focuses on the middle income piece. Here we focus from a policy standpoint only on the low income.
We do a lot of economic segregation in housing in America. Mm-hmm. Think culturally something like that could work here in the States?
I do generationally. Yeah. I think that and I'm not saying that the older generations won't embrace it, some will. The same kind of folks that sell their house in the suburbs and are willing to move back to the cities. But by and large, young people come to housing very differently. One, because it's so scarce and it seems unachievable. And I think that younger people are just much more open to how they live. And so I think that in Vienna, people are proud to live in a mixed income community. They're proud that somebody might live next door to them who's exited the criminal justice system or been a victim of domestic violence or been a divorced parent. They embrace immigrants in that community in Vienna. So I think that there are parts of our communities that will embrace it, and it tends to be probably more the younger folks. Yeah. So people who want to have housing, nice housing, are willing to think that a mixed income community could bring that for all of us.
Yeah, we live in a neighborhood that I would call a mixed.
It's very mixed income.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Block to block, different size houses, lots, all those kinds of things, income levels, and I enjoy it. I like the diversity of my neighbors and friends that I meet, but I think I don't know if we are outliers, at least in terms of maybe not mindset, but in the opportunity to live in a space like that.
How do you think that people would adjust? Because a lot of the social housing, is it rent? Is it for rent or is it for ownership?
So culturally, they don't really feel like ownership's that important because rental housing is affordable and there's permanent tenure. So if you all lived in Vienna and you lived in a flat and it might be a 4-bedroom flat and you might have some children and one day you're going to get older and you might leave your flat to one of your kids and their spouse and their kids. So it's a model that's almost like homeownership in that your tenure's never threatened and there aren't really leases where you could be forced to leave. So that changes the outlook on housing. And then, so people just assume that I have the tenure that I desire. The second part is a part of their system that's a small part that they don't really appreciate that much, but I would like to bring to the United States. They have a model where you go into your flat and you know that in 10 or 15 years you can buy it. And there's no barrier of a big down payment. There's no barrier of you can't afford it. And you just naturally move from like flipping a switch. And I feel like if we could find some innovative developers to do that here, so many more people could become homeowners. Because renters have solid incomes and they make regular payments because if they don't, they're going to lose their home. So it's not like the behavior of a renter is inconsistent with the behavior of a homeowner. It's really other barriers. And of course, why do we want to be homeowners? Not only do we want to be homeowners because we control our future, our destiny, but because it's a wealth building tool for us. Mm-hmm. And that's a very American thing.
That was going to be my next question is like how it, in a place that has a broader social welfare state,
yep,
if you remove that kind of wealth generator that real estate is, how do you meet that gap?
I say we don't. And we have a very precarious social system safety net, which we see
yeah,
right now,
I'll
like
say the least.
Super scary.
Yeah.
I say, no, we accept that wealth building is part of the American mentality. And so, of course, what low-income housing does because of the covenants is your affordability is locked in forever.
Yeah.
That's good. That's one part of our housing system. But I think many of us would like to have our homes be wealth building. Mm-hmm. And so I just think, let's just change the model. Let's figure out how we can build housing that starts as rental that becomes homeownership housing. And so that it moves from an owner who releases, right, the units eventually to,
right,
basically it's condominiumship ownership. But then you are wealth building.
Yeah.
It's not actually complicated. It's complicated by laws around a lot of the condominium risk laws. But economically, we're building those apartments today anyway. And so if we can find mission-driven developers or social developers, if we can do it on public land where the government parties say this is how it's going to be, so we have this land, come build on it, we're going to keep the land, we're going to use the land to control that this is what the product is going to look like over time.
So there has been an effort in the state legislature to create some sort of social housing program in California.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what that's looked like and why it hasn't moved
very
far? Yeah,
I can. So social housing, again, is in Vienna, is the public sector land banking. The public sector, and since we've been going, they now do this. They hold it in a long-term ground lease, which is really smart. And then they have a really terrific set of principles by which they do their developers competitions, and they work, and those competitions yield high-quality housing, good design, good environmental stewardship, all of that. The word social, so social means of society, and the execution of that there is one-third low, one-third middle, one-third market. But people here still get caught up on social as in socialism, and that's not what it is. It's just mixed income housing. So one part is we're still stuck somewhat on the language, and people say, let's just call it something different. Okay, maybe, but let's just talk about what it is. It is a mixed income model for permanent affordability and tenure. So some of it is the leadership in the legislature being some of the younger and extremely progressive members. Some of it is definitionally those members don't even agree on what it is. And so the most left of the left really wants social housing to be all low income. That is not what it is. And the more moderate people and the people we take to Vienna intentionally to help them understand it, see it for what it is, which is mixed income communities. So some of it is the legislators that are leading it, and some of it is just not enough legislators understand it yet.
Affordable housing can be some of the most expensive housing to build. How would this not be, I'm thinking of like a mega project, how would this not be another version of the high-speed rail where you have cost overruns and it's unpopular and funding delays, those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's a great question. So social housing is really the master planning of the land and the bidding out of it. And so there's all kinds of developers. The architecture in Vienna is fantastic, and a lot of the communities will have 30 buildings and 30 developers. And there'll be co-ops that are people who love bicycles and family co-ops that love theater, right? And LGBT co-ops. And then there's just straight rental housing that's more the lower income housing or low and moderate, and mixed in with buildings that are condos. So it's really a lot like redevelopment was. The economic risk is always just at the single developer level. Okay. So that there's, in the biggest projects in Vienna, there's a master developer, and they master plan the infrastructure, and they master plan the retail. So to get a good retail mix. But the buildings themselves are all individually done by developers.
So in California...
So dispersed risk.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. So I know a little over a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago at this point, the governor wanted to get more housing built across the state on public land.
Yes.
The property that was designated in Fresno, there's been, to my knowledge, no progress.
I don't think that... Tell me what that property is, but I don't think it's been put out for bid.
I don't think it has either.
Yeah.
It's a former state office, and it's close to First and Shields in Fresno by a Target.
So we're the consultant on the governor's...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think it was very bold of the governor. And so in the early years of that excess sites program, it was targeted properties that went out. The new philosophy is open up the kimono and just let people bid on everything that's available. And I'm not sure exactly where we are in that, because it's a fairly new execution. So I don't think the Fresno property was one of those first waves ones that was featured. And was it a Caltrans property by any chance?
I don't remember.
Yeah, there are certain agencies in the state that have been less inclined to want their properties to go. But the state office buildings, we have one in San Diego, definitely went up for bid. So some of it is about local government leadership saying, hey, can you elevate that one and make it a priority? And so it could be that it just hasn't been of utmost importance to the mayor, or it could be, I don't know, that it's just the economics aren't here for it.
What does that program as a microcosm say about our ability as a state to build at scale if we went towards a social housing model?
So I think of social housing as being driven by local government or regional government leadership, but at a large site-by-site execution. So you have a fairgrounds you're not going to use. You have an industrial site that you convert. In Vienna, it's mostly converting industrial to housing, or train abandoned train lines to housing. It's never starts as housing land, so there's always a conversion. We have a little airport in San Diego that's been a topic of conversation. There's a fairgrounds up in Sonoma. The mayor of Long Beach has a public housing project site that's about 50 acres, really old stock, not very dense. So I do think it's a very deliberate intention to find appropriate sites and realize that the building of high-density housing in that mixed way is really additive to the community. Now, you have a lot of land downtown, and it can be bundled.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to have the vision to actually bundle it and then master plan the disposition of it for development.
I know Portland does a little bit of land banking for redevelopment, especially along their transit lines. Is there something to be learned from that process that we could take into the Fresno experience as well?
I look at all the land literally along high-speed rail,
yeah,
which I know they control, but those linear strips are an amazing opportunity. Mm-hmm. Programmatic design. Think of the High Line in New York.
And right. It
goes back to the Transcontinental Railroad. And,
it does.
Land along the lines.
Yeah.
That's where the wealth was found.
Absolutely. So it's really about it's about vision and political will. You have
easy
the raw material here.
So easy.
Yeah.
Do you have a city that's in a similar place as Fresno that we could look to for inspiration? Because we often feel different, right?
Yeah.
We're not coastal.
You may have observed that on your trips to Fresno.
But you know what? I think in California, we really need to talk about inland California and coastal California. We just need to really talk about those as really exclusive regions. And because everything is different economically. I think of the Central Valley communities. Fresno's done a lot of right things. And it may feel that's not fast enough to you, but you got the largest EDA grant in the history of the country here. Development takes time. I would say, not knowing the sort of civic leadership side beyond just elected officials, do you have a civic leadership group that champions it? Mm-hmm. So in San Diego, we have a great economic development corporation. Housing's not their thing, but my gosh, they champion a lot of things really well. We have a downtown San Diego partnership that's really worked hard on housing and is just micro involved in the downtown grid. And they are pro-housing. I guess I would just ask, is there a group of civic champions that is diverse enough to hold the message and hold the dream?
Yeah, we're circling back to where we started. Like, how do you identify this unicorn-like developer to come in and champion things?
I think you pretty much have to look in the mirror, right? No. You guys are here leading this dialogue, right? There's no magic person. There's only us. I hate to say it, right? There's only us, and I beat the same bandwagon on whatever my priority is for a few years, and then what catches on, I move to a different part of the narrative.
That's interesting.
It works for me. I was on our downtown redevelopment board starting in 2001. This is before homelessness was so explosive. And I started talking about, I barely knew what it was, but I started talking about permanent support, affordable housing. So I was on 9 years. So for 3 years, I talked about affordable housing, and we were actually not keeping up with our redevelopment quota. And so we had to build. So I talked about that for 3 years until the rest of the board began to talk about it. And then I moved on to talk about permanent supportive housing for another 3 years or so. And so now I talk about these themes of trying to have regional leadership, trying to think about our capital systems differently, and just supporting the leadership of ecosystems. And we take people to Vienna in clusters so that you come back in a cluster excited, right? And my job, I think, is to come in and ask community, I'm a pretty innovative person, right? So how can I support you? What do you need? Here are some of the great things, the questions you're asking, here are some of the great things that are going on or the emerging practices. I think you have a lot of very dynamic people here, and you have a lot of dynamic leaders and thinkers in the mid-range, right? 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and you all have the runway to keep at it. And it does take a while, but you've set the stage with the land use, and now the infrastructure is going on. I really feel like your vertical development is going to come.
We conclude these podcasts each week with what we're loving this week. I'm going to go ahead and start. I'm a librarian. That's my day job. And so do I talk about books all that often?
Occasionally.
I'm a compulsive reader. Holidays are great because there's downtime, so I read a lot. I'm reading two things I'm enjoying this week. One is a book by historian and scholar of religion. His name is Donald Lopez. And the book is called Buddhism, A Journey Through History. And I feel like most of my Buddhism was like learned through like mindful apps or meditation retreats with people in Big Sur, which is fine, but Buddhism.
Was it Buddhism that you learned?
They thought they were teaching me that. But if you read about Buddhism in other places, it's not what you would expect. And so I just finished a chapter that was looking at art in Buddhism and how Buddha is represented pictorially. It's super fascinating. So I've learned a lot from that book. And then the other book I'm reading this week is Neal Stephenson, who's a sci-fi writer who does like fantastic kind of hard sci-fi. And the book is called Diamond Age, and it's about AI and nanotechnology, and it was written so long ago. And so I'm interacting with my ChatGPT all day long, and so it's been fun to read through his lens in the past and seeing where he was on track with where things are headed. And so two good books that I'm reading this week.
I love that.
Donnie, what are you reading? Or what are you loving? Sorry.
I am a walking cliche. And so it is January. And so I am taking the inspiration of Marie Kondo, the Japanese woman.
What are you throwing away?
Everything.
Start over.
She doesn't encourage everyone to throw things away.
Are you hugging stuff too to see if it gives you joy?
I had to do this to my book collection, and that was...
Which is a tragedy in its own respect.
It is, and...
Did you thank each book for its service?
In my own way, I got rid of so much of my... Because I went to grad school, gosh, how many years ago did I graduate? 16 years ago now of this year, I graduated from grad school. So it's a long ways in the rearview mirror at this point. But I've been holding on to like my urban planning theory books for so long, and I had to say goodbye to many of my theory and philosophy books, and that was very sad. But I was telling Jordan offline maybe a week ago, I'm just not probably going to read Kant for fun or John Forrester for fun. And so anyways, that was very sad but very happy, because now my house feels lighter.
So the theme is, what am I loving this week?
Yes.
I love to read as well, and my spouse and I are reading a book on Stoicism. It's like a daily reader that my mom and dad gave us.
Is it a Ryan Holiday book, maybe?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's white, and so every day you read, there's a passage for every day of the year, and it's great. It really grounds you a lot in, which is particularly relevant in this moment in time, of focusing on what we can control. And I really believe... These are tough times for people who are living in a world of a lot of chaos. It can exhaust you. And I try and just stay focused on, I read the top lines in the news, but I really try and focus on, what can I change today? What can I contribute today? Loving the discipline of being thoughtful every morning. And it was my first week back at Stanford. It's my fifth year. I only teach once a year, but I teach housing policy course to undergrads. And I love it. I think I make 6 cents an hour because it's so time consuming. But I really believe that the young people are going to solve the housing crisis, because their crisis. And it's not my crisis. I own a home. But it is their crisis. And we see, right, new forms of wealth. AI is creating a lot of wealth. The internet creates a lot of wealth. We don't know what we won't see that will lift them and their incomes. But it's still a pretty... bleak picture for them at the moment. And so I love teaching them. We start with lived experience, and then we build to Ezra Klein and McKinsey and Bloomberg and all that stuff. But it's fun just to take them on a journey.
Yeah. So do you feel pretty optimistic with kids these days in terms of what's unique about their generation that you're learning?
They're resilient.
Okay.
They're really resilient. We now have the Stanford undergraduates were students in high school that did get to go back into the classroom after COVID. Yeah. I think that's so they're a generation that has good connectivity skills. And I just think they're very well versed in the reality of that they live in and that they've come from. And I think they think a lot about well-being of society. And whatever people might say about young people or not being hardworking or myopic or on their phones all the time, I don't see that in a lot of young people that I teach. And so I'm hopeful, right? I'm hopeful that there's always generations that are going to bring more creativity into the challenges of the world.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.